the Stone House, Reel 4. You were saying this jail was at...
Oh, the next day I was at Castres, and Louis Journal, Christian and I all went down together on the 3rd of November by train to Castres, and I was put into a jail in Castres. No interrogation there, and I spent... I was there for about a month, I think. Louis Jourdan I did not see again till after the war, or Christian. Now, when I said early on I made a mistake about declaring myself British, Christian did not, and of course now Louis, since he was not anyway. And in the beginning of December, a month after my arrival, more or less, at Castres, I was moved, taken out of Castres prison and sent to Paris, leaving Christian and Louis Jourdan in Castres jail. Now, at some time, in the beginning of 1943, Louis was sent back to Lyon to stand trial in the French court. Christian remained in Castres till when, I don't know offhand, till let's say the middle of 43 or April, May 43, and then the Resistance liberated a lot of the prisoners from Castres. And she was made her way up to Lyon and hid with the Jourdans, because by that time Louis had been acquitted by the French. Very extraordinary that. In Lyon, he was put on trial in the French court. I've seen the stuff in the French court. My name is never mentioned, and he is let free, acquitted.
It seems a very dangerous thing for her to have
but
done.
Because I asked Elsa this, is about 3 years ago when I was down there, and she showed me all the documents, and I said, how was that possible? How was it that you were never arrested? How is it that Louis was not deported like so many others? And he said, well, of course, Louis owned a lot of real estate in Lyon, had a lot of great connections in Lyon. And she said, you know, when Louis was acquitted, he was warned by the French authorities not to go back to his chateau because of, the Germans would come and pick him up there. They're waiting for him. So for about several months, they hid in France and eventually went back to him. So it goes to show that nothing was ever that simple, you know. How did they, the most extraordinary.
How had Blanche made
and
contact?
And Blanche with? Eventually got back to England in 43. I'm not sure of the details. I have to find out what the details are, how she got back. Extraordinary story. She hid with the Jourdans again. And then Zaire seem to remember, she arrived back, she's picked up off the coast of Normandy, went back, got back to England by submarine. I'm not sure that, or if she's picked up by Lysander, but she got back to England in sometime in 43.
Now, can we pick up your own personal story with you being taken to Paris?
So I arrived in Paris at the in solitary confinement at Fresnes. Then I was interrogated every day at the Ministère de l'Intérieur in Paris. And then eventually, on New Year's Eve 42 in Fresnes, my interrogator said, well, this is it, but you'll be shot as a spy. So I was never actually officially condemned, and I was never in court, but I expected from then on, you know, to be taken out and shot. And there's a funny story about this Gestapo man after the war. he hadn't beaten me up, but he had been a bit of a shit, you know, smoking and doing all the little tricks, eating in front of me. And he told me, you know, you're going to be shot. Arnold Schneider was his name. And I have photographs of him. I took out, after the war, I was stationed in Germany, in the VOR. Then I was demobbed in June 46. And I had some American friends in the American Army, and they got me a job as interrogator in Darmstadt, in an American enclosure for automatic arrests. The automatic arrest categories of at that time, all the people had been Nazis, Gestapo, whatever. They'd all been put together there. In fact, there was the Grand Duke of Hesse, who'd been an assistant of Hitler's. You know, Grand Duke of Hesse is part of the royal family. And I had I used to live in Frankfurt and commute in my little Jeep every day, go down the Autobahn to Darmstadt, and like going to the office, you're commuting. And it was lots of fun, actually. And that's why I had this portrait done by one of the prisoners. Anyway, I had my little office in the camp there, in the building, one of the buildings. There were several offices with some other American interrogators, and my job was to get, you know, to interrogate so many people every day and put down the info and scribble on a piece of paper. Then it was sent to a typing pool across the corridor, where staffed by German prisoners who spoke, and I don't know if they didn't have to speak English. Yes, they had to speak English, because all this had to be done in English. My interrogation was done in German, but it was all had to be typed down. And the following morning, the previous day's interrogation would come to me for signing. And I had my name on the door of my room, and I was plating the thing on my desk. And this man used to come in, you know, from the typing pool, this German prisoner. And I remember the first time he came, I was looking there, and he was standing there, and he wasn't, his head was bent, head was bent, and all I saw was this bald top of the head, and I said, that top of the head looks sort of vaguely familiar, but I had no idea who he was. And this went on for several days, and eventually, and I said something in, because after about 3 days, I said, well, why doesn't he ever look up? I mean, is he something wrong with his neck or something? And he looked up, and I recognized him. It was my interrogator from Paris. And he was absolutely petrified, because he'd recognized my name on the door. And then I told everybody in the American, and said, God, would you believe it? There's this Arnold Schneider, et cetera, giving the whole detail. And they said, well, you know what we'll do, Captain Stonehouse, we'll close the camp for the day. You can beat him, I'll do what you like with him, and here's a machine gun, and you can kill him, and we'll, no one will ever know. And I said, it's something they couldn't understand. I said, no, you know, I can't do that. I said, if I did that, I'd be no better than the Germans. And said, in any case, I'm free, he isn't. And
how had he behaved towards you in France?
Well, he'd never been an absolute, he'd never beaten me up or anything, but he was just, I mean, after all, he'd interrogated me for several weeks and threatened me, and he's the one who told me I'd be shot as a spy. So talk about turning the tables.
Did you do anything at all to him? Just ignored him?
No, I said, well, you know, I'm going to write out what I know of you. You see, I did told the strict truth that, and I wrote down a statement that he's the one who'd interrogate me and so on. And then it was out of my hands. No, I couldn't say, I didn't know him. It just get what's coming to him, if anything.
How long were you in France, do you know?
Yeah, I was in Fresnes almost a year in solitary confinement, and the till October the 23rd, 43.
And were you being constantly interrogated?
No, I was interrogated, you know, for the beginning, and then for another several weeks after this thing with Peter, you know, incident with Peter Lachaine. And the worst thing there was that I was sure I was going to be executed because that's what the Schneider told me I would be. And after all these lies, I remember the last set of statements I made, I admitted that the previous two set of statements, interrogation was a pack of lies. And I don't understand why I was never pushed, because I could have given away a lot of people. I was never asked. I'm sure I wouldn't have, but I was never asked. Very odd. When I hear others talk, that's why sometimes I hate to say this, but when I hear some of the people being beaten up for less reason than I wasn't beaten up for, if you see what I mean. I sort of wonder a bit.
So you don't think anybody suffered because of your own interrogation?
Oh, that I know. Absolutely nobody. Nobody suffered because of me. Nobody. Absolutely no one. And that's the thing, I don't understand why I wasn't forced. I could have told the Germans Madame Jourdan knew all about me, which she did. I mean, my cover story was with her, for instance. The reason for my being in this chateau in the first place, cover story-wise, was that Madame Jourdan and I had met in Paris before the war, and she'd been with Lucien Leland. She'd been a model, and she had all these beautiful clothes from Leland, and I had done some fashion drawing. So this is where we were supposed to have met, you see, and I was supposed to have drawn for French Vogue before the war. Well, I was practically too young anyway, but that's how we were supposed to have met, you see. And I suppose my role from outsider in France was, she still had connections with North Africa, the House of Leland, North Africa, and but that's how we met, because we were in the fashion world in Paris. Of course, I never was. This was, and that's where, in that book at Fotosrit, you know, SOE in France, they give my cover story as my true story, which it isn't at all.
So that's a mistake in
my book. Oh, yeah, and it's been repeated in every other book that I was a fashion artist in Paris before the war, and there's not a word of truth in it. It's my cover story for Madame Journal. It always irritated me that, because my true story is I was a gunner.
But is it an accurate account of your cover story?
More or less, yeah. But it's not my story at all.
How did you stand up to the solitary confinement?
Looking back, I don't know how I did, looking back. Well, look, you can see me today, you know. I must be very tough, actually, in my own way. I've never had a nervous breakdown, something to look forward to. I couldn't go through that again for all of us in China. But for instance, I used to, you know, after I told her, you know, from Christmas 42 till October 43, well, after I thought I'd be shot as a, you know, be executed, not shot, executed as an agent, enemy agent. I think twice a week, I forgot how many times a week, at 4 a.m, I think it was, or 5 a.m, the guards would come around and get the people out of their cells of whoever was going to be executed that day. And I could hear those footsteps. Steering myself for them to stop at my door, which they never did. But I don't know, I'd go out of my mind now if I had to go through that. for, you know, what is it, almost 9 months.
Where were you taken to in October 1943?
Then in October 23rd, 1943, I was sent to concentration camps in Germany. And it's then, by that time, I'd already spoken to Pat O'Leary. His voice, you know, we used to yell at each other through the windows. One could do that in France. And we met, he was on the same transport as I was, and so was Tom Groom, who's an Australian, who was also was, I think, MI9, worked with Pat, and John Hopper, Ian Hopper, who now lives in Norfolk, who is an Englishman who lived in France, in Paris, and had married a French woman, and he had a fantastic story. He tried to do his bit for the, you know, for the Allies in Paris, and he was not SOE. He wasn't attached to anybody over in this over here in England. He was a freelance, so to speak. And one day, he and his wife, at one noon, were surrounded in a cafe by the Germans. And there was a shooting match, and his wife was wounded. And he finished her off there. Rather than, and then after that, he spent 18 months in Fresnes, solid confinement in chains. And ever since then, right up till today, once a year, at the period of his wife's death, then he goes completely out of his mind. There's a person you ought to talk to, actually. But if you, I don't know if you'd want to. But anyway, he was on the same transport as I was. Pat O'Leary, Tom Groom, and then we went to Saarbrücken overnight to Saarbrücken. It was the same day, that's right. Which was a small concentration camp, where we stayed, as I recall, about 3 weeks. And then we were sent on to, by train for 3 days to Mauthausen, a concentration camp, which was the worst of all the ones, the most horrifying place.
Why was it worse than the others?
Just the way it was built is in Austria. We were already being beaten up in Mauthausen, and there's a lot, you know, all sorts of being, you know, made, all this, doing all sorts of exercise, forced exercises and so on. And Pat was beaten up by the one of the Gestapo. Pat was then supposed to be British, you see, like we were, like I was, and Johnny and Tom. Except actually, of course, in fact, he's Belgian. But he was, all through the war, he was as a British, you know, supposed to be British. He's supposed to be Canadian, French-Canadian. And I always used to wonder, how come a French-Canadian has a name like Pat O'Leary? You know, and his English wasn't that good at the time. Anyway, he is a marvelous person, absolutely extraordinary. And we arrived in Mauthausen. There were a couple of Jews in our transport, a very old man. And in Mauthausen, there was a quarry. If any Jews arrived there, they were segregated immediately. And they were made to carry blocks of stone up 187 steps. So I worked in the quarry and had to do that same journey up and down. But they had to carry these big weights up, and when they were exhausted, they were lined up on a cliff, and it was called, you know, very wittily by the Germans, the parachute jump. And they were pushed over and killed on the rocks below. And there were these two in my transport, a young Frenchman, about 17, Jewish. And there was this old boy. I remember at night time, we could see these lights at the top of this hill in in Austria. This is but near Linz on the Danube, Mauthausen. And all built of granite by Spaniards, Spanish prisoners, and Russians. And the next day, I remember helping this old man with some of his luggage. We were getting out of the train at the station. We had to walk about a couple of miles up to the camp during the dark. And with German guards and dogs. And I helped the old boy with one of his cases. But anyway, I heard the next 2 or 3 days later, this young Frenchman, he went through the routine. He was separated and put in a separate block and was pushed over the cliff. And, he sang the Marseillaise.
As he went over?
Yeah.
So you were doing quarry work yourself in Mauthausen. What, day after day, was it?
Yes, then I worked for some time in the quarry myself, carrying bags of cement, Portland cement, in the snow. I remember getting beaten up by a guard once because the bag was made of paper and split. Because of the snow, it got soaking wet. Then Tom and I were sent to another camp, an outside camp in the outskirts of Vienna, which was an aircraft factory. And there I started, it was quite extraordinary. There, when we arrived, we had E for England on our prison garb. With the red triangle, and then E. And the commandant of this camp at Wiener Neudorf, we were lined up, and of course, for some reason, we were in the front row, getting off the train. We were in the front row, somewhere, a place we always avoided, because the survival in camp was to always be trying to be in the mid-center row, always inconspicuous, But this... SS marched up, and I saw these two E's, and he said, "What's that, E? Englander?" And he was absolutely flabbergasted, and he said, "We both had to step out of the ranks," and we said, "God, this is it." And he sent us to work in the kitchens, which was unbelievable.
That was the best place to be.
Absolutely. And I discovered that he'd been a prisoner of the British in the First World War, and this was his way of showing his gratitude for the good treatment he received. Then he discovered I could draw, and that's when I started doing portraits. I did portraits of... I didn't have to do any slave labor. I've had enough food and cigarettes. And within a month, I became one of the most important prisoners in the camp. Because I had my own little room, I didn't have to go to work, I was completely protected by him. And I was able to help Tom. We got all these extra rations and food, and were able to sort of build up our strength. And I did portraits, he had lots of girlfriends, and then the other SS did portraits of their wives, and so on, mostly from photographs. And they were tickled at the idea of... an Englishman doing these portraits in them, and I remember one of them, one of the SS, I signed the drawing with my name and Vienna, Austria. Said, "Well, this isn't Austria. This is Greater Germany," which to them it was, you see. And I said, "To me, it's Austria." That's one of the little things. And then I spent Christmas there. We spent Christmas there 43. And then in January 44, February 44, the commandant left, and so my protector was gone. And then then sort of all hell broke loose because the camp, the elder, the camp was run by a prisoner who was called an elder, an Altester. He took his orders from the from the SS, you see. But he was, the SS delegated the orders through him to run the camp. And I had come along and become as important as he had, and so he was gunning for me. Why, I don't know. But so once my protector left, Tom and I were in great danger of being decimated almost immediately. And well, we were, for some reason or other, we were called back to Mauthausen, the mother camp, which is, and Tom and I, we were in our striped uniforms with our clogs on and no hair, you know, all shaven heads. And we were taken between two guards, first by a train to Vienna, and then across Vienna in a streetcar. We all, you know, with everybody, I remember seeing Vienna, and surprised how many soldiers were around with limbs missing. And then we took from Vienna, from the, I think, the Ostbahnhof, and I remember seeing at the station a bust of Empress Elizabeth. Oh, funny little things you remember. Then going up by train, the local train to Mauthausen, past that marvelous Baroque, is it convent? I've forgotten the name of it, on the Danube, all up along the Danube, to Mauthausen. Of course, we were scared shitless because we thought we were suddenly brought back to Mauthausen to be executed. And we sat in a compartment, Tom and I, without German SS and local other passengers. And Tom and I were talking in English. And the to attract attention of the other passengers. But nothing happened. Anyway, we arrived at back at Mauthausen in the evening, and we were put in the bunker, which is the place also where the executions were done. You know, the Schuss, right next in the cell next to us. And he said, "My God, we're for it." And we thought we'd be executed, and that's why we were brought back. And but we were, the next morning we were put into the camp. Back was I don't know if Pat was back then, but Bob Shepherd was there. That's where I met Bob Shepherd, by the way. You know, after I met him in London in Orchard Court, but that's where I came up against him again. And we did all the camps together, Bob and I, and Pat and Tom. We did all the camps as a group. And then from there, I started working again down in the quarry. And then Pat, who made some connection, Pat was a doctor, so made connection with some prisoner doctors. And they, for some reason, got us into the Russian camp, out of the main circulation there. And I didn't have to work in the quarry anymore. And then, and it's in Mauthausen that it's extraordinary, the grapevine. Do you know, we heard about the landings in Normandy at 8:30 in the morning. We knew about it in Mauthausen.
On the day of the landing?
At the day of the landing. As of 7:30 probably, because we used to get up at 5, you know, had to get up. We knew about the landing.